Yo, is this, this,
yeah,
this...
yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't see you. So
all right, sick.
We're good.
Nice. Ah,
man. All right,
and we're recording here?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, this right. is just, we don't have to start just yet. This is supposed to be a fun episode. You know, we're not getting into, you know, too much heavy shit this time. We're going to be talking about cartoons and their global, cultural, and ontological impact. I don't know if that's a pretentious way to announce it, but yeah, this is the cartoon episode. And who better to talk to than Mike Bolandic on the subject? So nice. Mike's been on before. We're going to have some fun this time. You know, it's the very end of the year. It's time to have some fun. So I don't know. How you been, man?
Pretty good. I was just at the supermarket. I got some sushi. And they were playing Nothing But a Good Time by Poison.
Oh, awesome.
While I was buying it, so I started getting in a good mood. So I think I'm feeling pretty good here. And, I've just been tapped in, going deep into, Fred Flintstone cartoon world. And I think that's a good place to be right now.
I think so, too. And, I mean... We got a whole, same here. I was just watching tons of Dexter's Lab and going through like the entire kind of rundown and story. And I think Dexter is really relevant, you know, especially his like, you know, his rivalry with Mandark, his evil nerd boy genius counterpart. And he kind of represents like, I don't know, like the Peter Thiel, Elon Musk faction.
Yeah, it's like nerds versus nerds.
Yeah, and then like Dexter's like the, you know, he's arrogant and he's like a true polymath. He's like a proto, I don't even know how to describe it. There's not, I don't know, he's like Alexander Grothendieck or somebody who just like, he's really smart and he has like this kind of broader ethical vision for humanity. He's not a mathematician. He's more of like a physics person. But you know what I mean? But it's like funny because the story with Mandark, who's like the evil nerd, is he grows up in this utopian hippie community. His parents are hippie vegans. And so they like shove all this stuff down his throat. And then he decides he's going to become evil and worship technology.
Whoa, that's like a true contemporary tech bro here.
No, it's crazy.
I like Dee Dee's look a lot.
Oh, same. Well, you know, Mandark falls in love with Dee Dee. And then Dexter uses that to his advantage. Because he, you know, Dee Dee's like really destructive and kind of tramples on everything. And, you know, throughout the entirety of the show, she just kind of ruins all his experiments and like clones herself a bunch. And it's like this funny thing because like Dexter's this person who was born into like a pretty, I don't know, sub average intelligence family, but he's like the really smart one. So he's always grappling with this fact that he's like hide his laboratory from his parents.
Everyone's supposed to relate to this character because they're the supreme genius.
You know, I guess so. I mean,
but Dee Dee is like, and I love Dee Dee's like, for some reason, I was just focused on her. She's like, she's bringing back all these like memories of these. She's like pre American Apparel. She's like a proto e-girl thing where she got those tube socks. Ponytails, and it's like I knew 1,000 women like this that were at the time that was sort of like a Powerpuff Girls aesthetic too. That it's like loudmouth raver, you know, getting in everyone's business and won't shut up, but like wants to. And that's kind of the only way I've ever seen any of this of the Dexter or Powerpuff Girl type thing is knowing a couple Dee Dee-esque people in my lifetime.
Right. But, I think of that time with like the sneaker pimps. And like,
1,000%.
Like K-Rock Weenie Roast.
Even that, like Bjork's like logo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bjork is like, it was so weird that
there's all these clothing stores that I keep seeing that have those same sort of font as like the whole thing. And that it's really like, is
like even like the whole Heaven Marc Jacobs thing, you know, it's got a little bit of that too.
It's the Y2K aesthetic.
Yeah. I mean, all this stuff kind of came out at that point. But it's like weird though, because I feel like the moral and ethical arc of Dexter is so much more, you know, this is a show for kids and it's so much more complicated than the aesthetic rehash, like kind of makes it out to be in a weird way, because it's like all about this, you know, it's basically like a tech reality show, you know, or something like that, where it's like you have these competing factions of nerds and, you know, there's like the whole evil nerd theory and then there's like the good nerd and they're just sort of battling it out and they're time traveling towards the future where like one of them actually does become like a technocratic despot and Dexter, you know, is digging this hole to become this like buff guy so that he could defeat him and like clone himself a bunch of times. It's like actually kind of crazy, but I mean, that's neither here nor there.
Well, it's really interesting how I really think Revenge of the Nerds is one of the most underrated movies ever. And it really is like,
oh, totally.
It's almost like our Citizen Kane. It's like, this is one of the great works of art of our lifetime. And it really predicted everything about these diabolical sort of tech stuff, the identity stuff, these nerds who are nice guys, but also rapists versus, you know, the jocks. And then it became like, they just won, you know, and like the whole jock concept sort of fizzled out. And then it became like a nerd versus nerd was the dominant sort of narrative, I think, of our time. And now you keep seeing traces of like people trying to return to a trad thing or a normalcy thing. But every time I see Bannon, he reminds me so much of John Goodman in Revenge of the Nerds, the coach. And even yesterday I heard him do some talk where he was calling these tech guys nerds, you know, and he's saying it almost in the same inflection as John Goodman. And it's just a weird thing. But yeah, the nerd versus nerd.
Yeah, it's also weird because now there's that whole like, you know, H-1B skilled worker schism that's like tearing everybody apart. And like, I'm just like, this is an utterly pointless conversation.
I'm sorry I even brought this up, because it's like, I don't need to hear what like some guy who like outputted a HD cam tape for me in 2001 thinks about visas or thinks about Jimmy Carter, that he really was bad or really was amazing. It's like,
right.
I care about stuff, but I think we both sort of got it back into cartoons because, you know, really not looking to hear that right. noise, you know, I'm just trying to see something that, you know, makes me feel good, that is entertaining to me and is creative, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the world is full of pain and, you know, cartoons are, I don't know. You know, it's like, there hasn't been a ton of theorizing about cartoons, but you know, it is this kind of blurring between reality and fiction, and that like the characters and settings and narratives, they're kind of like, it's kind of creating this hyper real world that feels sometimes like as valid or more valid than real life, you know, and it kind of reimposes itself on real life too, which is kind of weird, which is why you see it in fashion and advertising. And you wrote a really great essay for GQ about the kind of global impact of the Flintstones.
Yeah. You know, I sort of get into it just from, yeah, like real life, you know, seeing clothing that people wear, walking by weed stores, you know, being at someone's house and, you know, what's on the TV, you know, and I think I agree with you about the theorizing stuff, that it's just one of those things that doesn't lend itself to it, where it's like, you know, books about jokes, you know, it just doesn't work, you know.
Right.
This is why I don't read graphic novels or there's these crazy, there's certain cartoons that are considered smart that people write essays about, and that's a turnoff almost, you know. I'm just looking for the uncut kind of stupidity, you know.
Right.
But yeah, Fred was sort of, yeah, maybe that's, but even like, yeah, Dexter, like, I just think of that as like, because I was too old to watch it as a kid. So it would either be, yeah, through these girls, the loudmouth girls, or like being at like a buffet restaurant or a family restaurant and seeing it on mute, you know, in the corner of the thing, and sort of taking things in more that way, you know, than actually sitting down watching it, studying it.
I just kind of put it on the background because it helps me.
Yeah.
Like it helps me do other things. You know, it's like, especially with music stuff, like if I have cartoons on, then I can, you know, even if I'm not really paying attention to the plot, it just, there's something about it that's like, I don't know. It's just like a kind of ritualist. It's like a, I don't know. It's a reality breaking mechanism to get you out of the monotony of these like voices that of society that tell you like the way things should be. And, you know, like having to hear some guy, you know, you went to high school with talk about like Jimmy Carter, you know, like, I don't.
Well, it, no, and it was music that was sort of, that was the beginning of the Fred Flintstone piece. Was, so I made this movie, I don't know, 2010 called Happy Life, that was about an all techno music record store.
It was awesome.
And then they did like a series of my stuff like in 2019 at this theater, and they asked me if I would do like a VJ set, like a live VJ set after the screening. So I was like just pulling through all these videos of techno music, dance music that I like, you know, which is just sort of Eurodance, poppy, you know, mainstream music. And so I dug up all these videos that I'd never seen before. And the one through line they all had was there was like a ton of fucking Fred Flintstone in them. And there was a ton of Smurfs in them. And these were mostly from like the Netherlands, Germany. And it was, and I was like, and those were the parts that played the best. So I was kind of like, just started looking into what the fuck's up with Fred in Europe and Smurfs in Europe. And then, so I'm going through like the charts, the European like radio charts and stuff. And you realize that like in 1995, there's like in the Netherlands, there's 3 platinum albums by the Smurfs that are just remakes of dance records, you know, like Smurf the House, Smurf and House Party. And it's all Smurfed up where it's high pitched, you know, chipmunks, like Smurfs doing dance music. But it's like the biggest thing of the year. And then they did a cover of No Limit by Two Unlimited. That song's number one for 6 weeks in the Netherlands.
Geen Strauss, maar Smurfenhaus!
Schlumps go techno or something.
Cotton Eye Joe by the Rednecks was a big hit.
Yeah, so that shit is number one for like, it's double platinum in Germany. So you're looking at the chart, it's like the charts of Europe in the mid-90s. It's all just fucking Smurfs. Red Flintstone, Rednecks are like bigger than the Beatles. They were like,
yeah, it's crazy.
Number one for years. And then in the US, it's like Hootie and the Blowfish, Boys to Men. And it's like, you realize there's this alternate sort of world that was going on. And it really wasn't until like alternative music that sort of ironically killed the whole thing. And but so I got really into like the Smurfs music and the Fred Flintstone stuff. And then I did this sort of radio show for the Safdie Brothers for Lara FM during COVID. So I just was like deep cover going into all of those, you know, each one would be by theme, like outer space, kids, white raga, opera music, but all dance versions. And then you see that like even more cartoon stuff is in it. It's all Looney Tunes stuff. There's Sesame Street stuff. And like, what the fuck was going on? And I mean, I have a lot, there's a few theories as to what was happening, but you know, I think the best ecstasy in the world was coming out of Amsterdam in the 90s.
Right. Have you ever seen like a Flintstones or Smurf impressed ecstasy pill?
I've seen images. I've never personally taken one. I mean, I guess the Stone Kids vitamin.
No, but have you seen an
image? Oh, yeah. There's a German movie called... I forgot what it's called, where it's like all about like raver kids, and they do a Flintstones rave and they take some ecstasy that's like that. And then this cop comes and busts the rave and he says, yabba dabba to you.
You wrote about that. It's so crazy. I mean, just seeing like the clothing of that era, and like you also talk about the Fred Flintstone house. I think that's pretty interesting too. You know, like and you also said like we should throw a rave in there. So what is it about cartoons that you think have like real staying power in the age of artificial intelligence?
Oh God.
Like, I mean, I have some ideas, cause I kind of relate it to graffiti. Like to me, graffiti, like cartoons are kind of like a gateway to graffiti, which is interesting because it's also a gateway to like head shop culture and aesthetics, and like Glow Gang with Chief Keef. Sorry, I've got crazy bad vocal fry right now. But
no, definitely. I mean, the graffiti, there's a lot of things we're talking about here. I mean, we'll get into the clothing later, but right. The graffiti stuff. Yeah. It's interesting. I was watching part of Wild Style recently.
Oh, awesome.
You know, and there's a whole part where they're doing, you know, Dick Tracy and all the stuff. And, you know, all that early electro music, that early Afrika Bambaataa, you know, they're sampling like the Pink Panther, and, you know, woodpeckers from space, you know, it's like Woody Woodpecker, like laughing while people are breakdancing. And yeah, there really was a thing early on. And I think we'll get more into him later, but I love Kenny Scharf,
yeah.
Keith Haring, Basquiat. These guys are all doing graffiti, and you have sort of Fab Five Freddy, I think, is this guy who has a foot in all of these worlds. But I was reading this great story about Kenny Scharf, where he moves to New York in like the late 70s. And he has a crew with like Keith Haring and Basquiat. And he said the very first graffiti he ever did was he borrowed some spray paint from Basquiat. He goes up to a wall, he paints a television. And then in the middle of the screen, he just writes the Flintstones. that was his tag. And then he he starts graffitiing Fred Flintstone everywhere. So you get these three freaks going around tagging everything up. He's doing cartoons, they're doing their doodles and the poems and whatever. And and it's this crazy thing where you see him today and this guy's like still graffitiing Fred Flintstone everywhere. You know, it's a real really respect that commitment, you know.
Yeah, totally.
And but you posted that great photo of a mural the other day that was like Top Cat and all these guys, you know, it's still,
that was just like local in Austin. I saw it at a park in just like a man-made basin, and it really kind of reminded me of that Fab Five Freddy, you know, early Zephyr, you know, that just like, because cartoons and graffiti, they were so deeply integrated. You had Smurfs and you had those, like, who are those characters from the heavy metal movie? But that's kind of what I related it to, just because, like, there was actually one of the buildings, it was a cartoon building. They did a lot of stuff, outsourced animation for Nickelodeon. It was kind of by my high school, but they had this massive graffiti mural with, like, people like Risk and a lot of the WCA guys who had this, like, LA graffiti is by and large really ugly. You know, it has this kind of, like, Geiger-ish, like spindly cholo vibe that I don't really get down with. But there was like a whole subgroup in the 80s that went by West Coast Artists, and a lot of them were kind of from the Venice area, Culver City area. So you would see this, and you would also pass by like a Kenny Scharf building, and it was just like you would see quasars and atoms, and, you know, there was something so like astral and space age about it. And it kind of also goes back when talking about like hip hop, it's, you know, Sun Ra and like Afrofuturism and, you know, kind of like Parliament Funkadelic and all of these kind of coming from a place of like the margins or, you know, on the outskirts of society and trying to create a new world for yourself within it. I see cartoons like fulfilling that.
I'm curious how much of like PCP and Angel Dust has to do with.
I mean, probably. I know Basquiat, Keith Haring, Kenny Scharf. They did a lot of drugs, you know.
Yeah, I think different drugs create different styles of art and different, you know, subcultures, and sometimes is a big element. But I grew up in downtown Chicago, and I had a similar thing where the graffiti we had is all just menacing. Esoteric gang symbols, you know. I don't remember many like Baby Hueys or like Donald Ducks. It was
right.
You know, it wasn't really till I got here that I got saw a little more eclectic ness. But I guess that sort of also leads to another hip hop thing. So it was like I feel like also like so in Chicago, I was saying that the big style was kind of, you know, it's a very like male city. It's like everyone's just wearing starter jackets, everyone's kind of a fat ass, everyone's mean mugging all the time, and it was kind of proud of not being fashionable. And then I come to New York and everyone's, you know, like looking like Cameron and wearing, you know, pink fur coats, right. And stuff. And then I came back to Chicago one time, and this is when Chief Keef comes out, and it's like all of a sudden he's wearing everyone's wearing these like tight polo shirts with like, let's say like España or some like ridiculous football, right, you know, soccer club. And then the next thing you know, everyone is just wearing these like emojis, glow man, cartooned out, pure trippy, like toddler style Teletubby look, which was totally different than that early cartoon hip hop thing. You know, this was like a more child, feral child soldier thing or something. I don't even know, you know. The glow man is an interesting character.
Totally. I wanted those glow gang Air Force Ones so bad. they were basically just like Air Force Ones, but cheaper, but and like three times as expensive, with just like the drank head star with like the kooky eyes. I wanted those shoes so bad. I think I might like try to cop those, like used or just like secondhand or on eBay. I have to have them. They're so sick. But yeah, I mean, that was, you know, Chief Keef, I think, is, he's a pretty inspiring person. But I remember when he first came out, there was something really scary about it, you know, like just because it wasn't even like the gangsterism, because I'd already been exposed to that throughout, you know, the 1990s. Like that wasn't anything new. It was just the way it was so stripped down, and it was almost like, okay, the floodgates are open now, you know, like you can kind of, like
I remember a while, some guy like staring me down wearing like a Tiny Toons jacket, you know, I'm like, this is like a different kind of experience. I saw some guy pass out a few months ago in like a Pikachu onesie with like a samurai sword, you know, blasting, like some like hardcore music. And it's just, yeah, when you mix like childish stuff and scary stuff, it's a unique, like, I was reading really recently that Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw Massacre is based on Baby Huey.
Like, oh yeah, I read that too.
Buckling. And the whole idea is, you know, he's not a fully grown, Leatherface isn't a fully developed adult, you know, right. He's this dangerous, you know.
Well, he can't really talk, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
He's just like, you know.
Yeah,
just
and there's a whole thing about, like, that movie Baby Boy, the John Singleton, where, you know, it's, you know, infantilization, but also, like, you know, when you're an adult and stuck in this, you know, child fucking mentality, it can be scary. But then I was reading about this guy. We were talking earlier about, what's his name? Who is the creative director for Chief Keef. And I'm trying to find his name. He was like something. Yeah, wait, hang on one second. Yeah, Casimir Spalding, Glow Mula.
Right.
And I was seeing all these pictures of him like drawing like suns with smiley faces, drinking like lean. And it's this, all these like sort of, you know, really toddler, like friendly, you know, paintings. And then I read this quote from him, and he's like, you know, my whole life is based on pain. So I tried to never use gloomy colors. I want something that'll make you happy. I want something that when you come into the household, when you look at it, it's going to make you smile. So he's like choosing his colors based on, you know, trying to present this happy thing, but like for this like dark, crazy music, which is, I thought was interesting.
Yeah. I wonder how much of that has to do with Chief Keef being autistic, you know, this kind of childish, scary thing, you know, like, cause there was that whole thing with like Rhyme Fest, how they're like, the industry is, he said, they're weaponizing his autism to like keep the narrative of violence, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, well, like, it seems like it corresponded with everyone getting into lean and stuff. You know, that wasn't really a Chicago thing, you know?
Well, that was a Houston thing.
Yeah, so around 2012, 2013, these things happened at the same time, so I don't know. But, no, I love the idea of like picking, and this is kind of what you were talking about in some of the previous episodes, is like making art just based on what colors you like and what colors you don't like. You know, I was talking, Abel Ferraro was telling me a while ago, that one year he got really mad at the Jets. Like, they lost a big game and he was just furious with their season. So he said he went like a whole year where he said, I don't ever want to see the color green in any of my movies, you know, because they remind me of the Jets who are pissing me off. So like King of New York, there's no green in it, you know? So yeah, just the idea of making a palette from what color makes you happy, what makes you unhappy, you know, it's like really,
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because I mean, even back in the 18th century, you know, when the Blue Boy was painted, I was just reading about this, you know, the Thomas Gainsborough painting. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's at the Huntington, but he was telling his students that like blue, and it was kind of known in painting that blue should never be at the foreground of any painting. You know, it's just, it looks bad. It's a bad color. Compositionally doesn't work. And then he came out with the Blue Boy, who is like this boy in this blue suit. And it kind of, and it was just based on, he made a painting as a kind of experiment to like, well, what if we actually made a painting based on color and we just called it the Blue Boy?
Yeah. No, and that's, and sometimes that's all you need to make something incredible, you know?
Exactly. And it ended up being one of the most famous paintings.
Yeah.
So
well, we can talk much more about him later, but Jean-Charles de Castelbajac.
Oh, yeah.
Is great fashion designer who co-founded Iceberg, and he was responsible for putting a lot of Looney Tunes and cartoons into European fashion in the, you know, 80s, 90s. But I was reading an anecdote from him where they hired him to redesign the first class section of Air France. And they said the only rule is you can't use bright colors. You know, you have to use sort of muted, toned down stuff because bright colors are some plebe shit, you know? And he did this proposal where he said, well, I want to make the whole thing colorful. And, you know, he did not get the job because of that. But you know, he's another of these like very colorful supremacist guys.
It's, I mean, it is really kind of interesting just to see how you also sort of wrote in a kind of primer, you know, how you were getting kind of annoyed with all this contemporary writing about raves and partying and how everything's politicized. I'm not of the opinion that things that are called political are actually political, because like politics entails a lot more than just identity and subjectivity and culture and society. There's also material processes. There's also, you know, how do we get our stuff? There are people who have like massive indexes of trade restrictions and terror. You know what I mean? Like, there are things that are political that we take it for granted because it's not at the forefront of the surface, because it doesn't feel like it's something we can control or we have any input.
To me, this just goes without saying, you know, the politics are the friends you make along the way, you know, doing stuff on your own, doing stuff with your friends. And like everyone knows that was like what made raves cool, was anyone can go to it. You're breaking into a space. You're having fun. People are coming together. This is like the opposite of rocket science, you know?
Yeah.
And then everyone all of a sudden tried to force these narratives about like it telling me why this is like this, and then making laundry lists of rules, like, you know, like, yo, you have to have consent. Like no shit, you have to have consent. It's like a, like, don't bring a gun to a playground, you know, like, and they would be about, oh, like Narcan, is there going to be Narcan there? Is there, you know, how does this affect the environment? Is it all dudes at this thing? Are they straight? It's just like, shut up. You know, it's like, you're really not, you're taking away the fun from this process, you know? Right. And it's just like the writing about everything. And when you have to explain how much fun you're having, it's clearly it's a forced narrative. And I don't know, it was just turning me off. I don't dislike all that stuff, but it was just like, why are you trying to strip the last humor and fun and by stating, you know, stuff that we all know? And that was so to me, Fred Flintstone was kind of like, he was a perfect sort of avatar for what I was thinking about, which is just, you know, yabba dabba doo is like a phrase, is so great. And he's like a caveman.
But he's also a family man. Like, he's kind of trad.
He's got it all.
But he doesn't have to explain why he's trad. You know, it's just it doesn't have to be stated why there's some, you know, you don't have to give ideological baggage to like having a wife and child and like a pet and a nuclear family. You know what I mean? Like, I feel it's kind of exactly what you're saying on both sides. It's like, you don't have to give that much context. Like, it's fine. You know, that's the way it should be with like everything.
Like, yabba dabba too is like the perfect word. You know, it's like it's just something that feels great to say, yelling it out. And his outfit is the iconic, it's, you know, the pelt, it's almost like a toga. You know, this is like just the essence of, you know, what you want to do when it's time to party, you know?
Yeah.
And I was reading this Paul Morrissey stuff because he died recently, and I was going through some old interviews. I couldn't find the quote exactly, but there's, you know, he was like pretty conservative, and he was like talking all this shit on like Woodstock and rock festivals. And he was saying that, you know, in this, I guess it's the early 70s, he's saying people had it so good that they had to start creating problems for themselves to get worked up about. And he was saying that drugs are kind of like a way to just revert back to like a caveman mentality. And he said like the rolling around in the mud at Woodstock and just the free love and all this stuff is just like a, you know, like people are always looking for an excuse to go sort of caveman mode. And I was sort of thinking about how it did, yeah, this like Flintstone as a party animal coincides with this moment when raves start happening, when ecstasy starts happening, and even just the childishness of all that sort of Eurodance music. I was curious about doing drugs as a way to sort of revert back to like a childhood kind of way of nonverbal, you know, emotional spaz, you know?
Having to interface is exhausting, you know, like sometimes you just want to say nothing and just kind of be there. And
so I feel like, so back to the rap and cartoons, I feel like it sort of fell off of it. And like, so, but whenever I'd go home, I would sort of see different things. And when I was just in Chicago for Christmas, and I went to like a bunch of stores, and I was just sort of looking around, and I was kind of curious to see which cartoon characters I would see the most, you know? And it was less of a variety, but I saw so much Pink Panther that I thought that was really weird. And I was like, I saw like Pink Panther basketball jerseys, bucket hats, satin jackets, figurines at like shoe stores. And like, I couldn't really, I was trying to figure out why. There's no specific, like, I don't think it's like a sports thing or like a, I was trying to figure out what it is about Pink Panther in 2024 that, why I was seeing it so much. But I was like, yeah, I don't know. I didn't come up with any good answers.
Right.
Other than like, yeah, you know, so I looked up Pink Panther Chicago, and then I found some like artist who's like a clothing designer, and he was like Bryant Giles, and he was like, he like designs like Pink Panther clothes, and he's like, it's like, sometimes I want to wear an emotion. If I really feel in a permanent mood for a while, I'll paint on a shirt and wear that shirt every day for 2 weeks just to say that's how I feel, this is what I'm wearing now. I was up at 3 a.m watching the Pink Panther, and the whole mysterious vibe he was giving off reminded me I wasn't returning texts or telling people my whereabouts. I hid behind that character for a while. So I put the Pink Panther on my shirt alongside portraits of myself. And I'm like imagining this guy just like depressed, hiding out, identifying as a Pink Panther. And then there's like some Virgil Abloh stuff, you know, where he was like Alexander Calder scale of justice with the Pink Panther on it. But, I have no fucking clue. I don't know. What do you think?
I just remember when I was a kid, you know, Coogee, and I remember the FUBU Fat Albert capsule collection where you had these big, like, vinyl stitched cartoon characters that were just like on people's asses, you know, in their baggy pants. And I thought that was pretty interesting.